Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It's been said that a cultural revival happened in Dublin in the early 20th century because a lot of clever people lived in the same town and hated one another cordially. But that's not how I see it. It seems to me that the same people were always involved in every single movement. Take my great uncle Edward Keegan as an example. He was a member of the same branch of the Gaelic League as Sean O'Casey. He was in the Lawrence O'Toole Pipe Band and he was elected first captain of their associated hurling team, succeeded by his friend the Abbey actor Sean Connolly. Connolly apparently was the first rebel to die in the Easter Rising, and Edward may well have been the second. In January 2016, I got a phone call from the Irish Times. A 1916 Veterans Medal awarded to Edward was to be auctioned in New York with a guide price between $3,000 and $4,000. The newspaper executives asked very courteously if it would be acceptable to the family if they were to make a bid. This was a poignant development. Edward had for years been a clerk in the advertising section of the paper, but he'd also been a member of the Irish Volunteers, fired from that job for his participation in the Rising. I called up my aunt Maura Dolan, then the oldest surviving member of the Keegan family, and I discussed the suggestion with her. She wanted to keep the medal in the family, but I feared it would in all likelihood just end up in somebody's attic. The newspaper was graciously offering to display it in a permanent showcase with captions as an act of perfect reparation. I convinced her to go along with this and the deed was done. The once pro-union newspaper had shown that times and attitudes had changed. It was, if you like, an act of perfect contrition. How that medal ended up in New York, we may never know. Perhaps it was stolen from the family home. Edward had been a most talented man, a gifted actor who appeared in W.B. Yeats's play On Ballya's Strand, which marked the opening night of the Abbey Theatre in 1904. He went on to play as a stand-in in Yeats's The Shadowy Waters, finding his part utterly incomprehensible. And the playwright, John Millington Synge, seemed to agree, saying that the baffling play should have been called The Second Mrs. Conkeber. Edward starred also in She Stoops to Conquer and in The White Cockade, as well as being taken on tour with Yeats's plays. In fact, W.B., whom the actors used to call Wonder Willie the Werewalker, thought so highly of Edward's gifts that he offered him full-time employment with the theatre. But Edward's mother, thinking Yeats was rather flaky, advised him to hold on to his steady, pensionable job in the Irish Times. Edward was a handsome man, and he also joined the Literary Theatre of Ireland, which offered him more heroic roles in plays devoted to the Rising of 1798. In one family photograph, he can be seen dying in the arms of the Countess Markovitch. The Literary Theatre was a sort of breakaway group led by Pádraig Colum, which wished to perform more propaganda plays as well as works in Irish. The Abbey benefactress Annie Horniman, an English lady, disapproved of such productions, and she withdrew support when the theatre failed to close on the death of King Edward VII. This may account for the reappearance of Edward on Abbey boards a few months later in a play called The Memory of the Dead. Events were now moving rapidly, and Edward joined the Dublin Brigade C Company of the Irish Volunteers under Éamon Kent. Their men fought in hand-to-hand combat before terrified patients in the South Dublin Union, seeking to repel a British army attack. Edward was one of the first wounded shot through the lung. He spent 4 months in the Union Hospital before a spell in Beaumont Convalescent Home. By the time of his discharge in August 1916, the newspaper had dismissed him. A lady of title, Lady Albinia Broderick, youngest daughter of a wealthy British family who had rebelled against her life of privilege, took him into her nursing home for wounded rebels in Kerry. She had renamed herself Gubnit ni Vrúdar, learned Irish, drained bogs, and formed a union to lead the Irish Nurses Organisation, as well as serving as a Sinn Féin councillor, which hardly pleased her brother, the Earl of Middleton. Poor Edward, despite her tender care, never fully recovered his health, but he did conduct a long and ultimately successful campaign for pensions to be given by the Free State to forgotten participants in the Rising. None of his brothers, who had all been in the War of Independence, took part in the Civil War, though they had all been in the War of Independence, but they saw the Civil War as a catastrophe and preferred to return to their work in the Gaelic League. I think there were hundreds who took a similar position, and that research should be done into these non-combatants. In 1922, Edward was appointed stocktaker in the Department of Local Government, spending 16 years in post, often in very bad health. Eventually, after prolonged sick leave, that employment was terminated. The Abbey Theatre kindly made him an assistant stage manager in the last days of his life, but he died from bronchitis in 1938, aged only 55, and he was buried in Glasnevin in an unmarked grave. His funeral service was conducted by Father Aloysius Travers, who had been spiritual counsellor to the condemned rebel leaders of 1916, and in 1941, Edward's widow Emily accepted the posthumously awarded medal. The Irish Times had issued a handbook of the Easter Rebellion about 6 months after the Rising, but in this Edward's name does not feature. Nor did it feature on the plaque erected on the wall of the Abbey Theatre to honour former participants on the 25th anniversary of the Rising. The names of Patrick and Willie Pierce, as well as Thomas McDonagh, were also mysteriously excluded. After a persistent campaign by the actor Stephen Ray, who laid a bunch of lilies in the Abbey every Easter, the missing names were added to an expanded plaque in Easter 2016. The grave, long-lost family memory was identified by Ian Gourley, whose ancestor had fought for the British Army in France in World War I. That ancestor's son had married Molly Keegan, a daughter of Edward, and Ian Gourley himself restored the grave. All of the Gourley and Keegan descendants united on the 19th of April 2016 for the unveiling of both the Abbey plaque and the Irish Times medal. It was one of those great, moving moments in the decade of commemoration, and even my Aunt Maura Dolan gave me a warm smile as the medal went on display. Her son, Michael Keegan Dolan, hopes to compose one of his future choreographic artworks to celebrate the life of our great uncle, and I'm sure it will be worthy of that illustrious man and of all who worked with him to bring art and idealism to revival Ireland.
My grandmother was born in Mayvor, County Westmeath in 1896. She was from a large family, 9 children, 4 boys and 5 girls, and they all lived well into old age, except for one of the boys who died in the big flu of 1918. Unusually for that time, all the girls, including Nana, were sent to boarding school in Forbann, County Offaly. After leaving school, Nana worked in Spicer's Bakery in Navan and then married and settled in Roscrea, County Tipperary. She gave birth to 2 sons, one being my father. Nana lived till the ripe old age of 98 years. For the last 10 years or so of her life, she lived happily in a nursing home in North Dublin. Coming up to Christmas in 1984, I went to pay my usual visit to my then 88-year-old Nana in the nursing home. I was 23 years old and proudly had my own car. During our usual chit-chat, she said to me, "You know, Jim, I've never been to the airport." "You're not serious, Nana," I said. "I am," she said. "Sure, I don't even have a passport." So I told her I'd take her there and we could have our tea there. "And Jim," she said, "would they do pork chops, peas, chips and tea bread and butter?" "I'm sure they would," I said. So a couple of weeks later, myself and my Nana headed for our tea to Dublin Airport. The minute we got out of the car in the car park, she said to me, "What's that smell?" It was aviation fuel, something she'd never smelt before. We made our way into the airport and up the escalator to the restaurant, which was heaving with people. This was back in the day when there was only one terminal and one self-service restaurant on the first floor in the airport. "You go find a seat," I said to Nana, "and I'll queue up and bring down your tea." The queue was long, but finally I got to the top of it and I put in my Nana's order. Pork chops, peas, chips, tea, bread and butter for the two of us. I put it all onto a large tray and looked around the restaurant for my Nana. She was a very small, slight lady with short, fair hair. Eventually, in a far corner, I spotted the back of her head. I made my way through the masses of people up to where she was sitting. Suddenly, three or four large, burly men dressed in black appeared in front of me with their arms folded. "Where are you going?" I pointed in behind them to the corner where Nana was. I said, "I'm going into my Nana with her tea." They moved to one side. As I was heading towards my Nana, I realised that she was sitting on the outside bench of her table and there were two men sitting on the inside. She'd obviously noticed a gap and had taken the spare seat. When I was about 2 or 3 yards away, I realised in shock and amazement that Nana was sitting beside George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley from Wham. One of the biggest pop bands in the world at the time, they just played two nights in the RDS. At that stage, I was hoping that the ground would open up and swallow me, but I had to continue. When I got to the table, I said to my Nana in a quiet voice, "Come on, Nana, we'll find another seat." Immediately, George Michael said, "No, sit down. This is the most interesting lady we've ever spoken to." So I sat down and the table of four was complete, with me, Nana, George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley. We proceeded to have our tea, this unlikely foursome. The two pop stars were warm and friendly, and the four of us chatted away naturally. I remember that they were fascinated with the fact that my Nana had been born in the 1800s, the last century. They appeared to be really interested in what she had to say. Then everything went quiet. My Nana leaned forward to me and she said in quite a loud voice, "Jim, these boys have earrings." Once again, I was hoping for a hole in the ground to open up. But the two pop stars laughed and laughed and were genuinely enthralled with my Nana. After we all finished our tea, maybe half an hour later, we said our farewells and left. Every time I hear Wham's Last Christmas on the radio, I think of that December day back in 1984 when my Nana visited Dublin Airport for the first time and had her tea of pork chops, peas, chips, tea, bread and butter in the company of two absolute gentlemen, Andrew Ridgeley and the late George Michael.
In my shoulder bag, I have three memorial cards. Two are of Mam and Dad, and the third is of nurse therapist Sheila Holland of St. Kevin's Psychiatric Hospital on Corksley Road. It's hard to explain why Sheila means so much to me, but I'll try. Many years ago, I heard the story of how Sheila had hauled bag after bag of sand up the front steps of St. Kevin's as part of a therapy project for her patients, and I went along to interview her when she retired. Sheila believed that if she created a beach area in a disused ward, her beloved patients would be able to transcend their grim surroundings and transport themselves in their imagination to a happier place and time. It was back in 1993 that consultant psychiatrist Dr. Ruth Mitchell gave Sheila the go-ahead to create a therapy unit for a group of 35 elderly male patients who were known to be restless, difficult and disturbed. Some of the staff were shocked to hear that the men were to be joined on a daily basis by a group of elderly women from a nearby ward. However, nursing officer Gerard Fitzgerald had great faith in Sheila and gave her full rein to try out her complementary therapies. Enlisting the help of the hospital's carpenter, Sheila created a beach area in the shadow of a seaside mural, filling it with sand, seaweed, driftwood and deck chairs. Thanks to a very basic tape recorder, the sound of the sea became the background music from morning to evening. Sheila encouraged each of the patients to take off their shoes and socks and feel the damp sand between their toes. Woonies Corkman would remind Sheila that her beach wasn't as good as the one in Garryvaugh. But for all that, he seemed to find a sense of peace and contentment there that had largely eluded him during a lifetime in St. Kevin's. The elderly ladies loved recalling the days they'd spent paddling with their young children down in Graball Bay in Crosshaven. Memories of tucking their summer dresses into their drawers often brought tears of laughter to the group. On one occasion, Sheila brought in a hard-boiled egg left over from lunch, which prompted a quietly spoken lady to recount the story of her little red hen, who always managed to lay her eggs inside the farmhouse, despite endless efforts to shoo her out. A sheaf of corn sparked memories of thrashings and big slabs of bread and ham washed down with strong tea and porter. One man who hadn't spoken for 8 years began singing "The Wild Colonial Boy." When he finished, there was silence, and then the clapping started, timidly at first, but gradually growing louder and louder, echoing to the rafters. Sheila brought in a group of unconventional artists who were eager to work with the patients. Among them was William Fro de la Fare, artistic director of Cork Community Artlink, best known now for its hugely popular Dragon of Shandon Halloween parade. William and the other artists didn't do art therapy with the patients. They did art, pure and simple, in all its gloriously messy, exhilarating forms. One patient, who came to be known as John the Painter, created colourful, bold pictures on old hospital bedsheets and cardboard that William had salvaged from skips around the city. John the Painter went on to have his own exhibition of outsider art in the Irish Museum of Modern Art in 2003. When Sheila reached retirement age, she had no choice but to step away from the haven she had created for her patients. She was heartbroken that the therapy unit closed when she left. She believed that a world of imagination, solace and solidarity had been opened up for the patients. And now they were left bereft. By this stage, the elderly ladies had already been transferred to another facility. And when St. Kevin's shut its doors in 2002, the elderly men were moved to a smaller hospital. Sadly, Sheila did not live long enough to enjoy her retirement with her much-loved family, passing away on November the 9th, 2003. My mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's around the same time, and my grief for both was intertwined. Today, the imposing red brick facade of St. Kevin's is being restored by the Land Development Agency as part of a social and affordable housing project. Now is the time to commemorate all those who lived and died in that forbidding hospital, as well as heroes like Sheila Holland, who championed the uniqueness of each individual who lived within its walls.
I want to read something to you. It's a line I found in an army pension memo dated from the 14th of February 1934, as I waded through some of the many thousands of files available online in the Military Service Pensions Collection. The collection is made up of applications for financial compensation by Irish revolutionaries on account of their activities from 1916 to 1923. As a historian fascinated by the legacies of the revolutionary period and the Civil War, the collection is nothing short of a treasure trove for somebody like me. Much of the contents are gripping and often affecting, but I want to read you one line that stopped me in my tracks. In certain types of cases of women applicants, the Pensions Board will occasionally require that an examination and report by a gynecological specialist may be necessary. I gasped. This officially typed memo confirmed a pattern I had already observed as I opened file after file of women activists. Throughout the 1930s, women were being sent for gynecological examinations to support or contradict their cases for disability or wound pensions. In most cases, these claims had little to do with their gynecological health. They related to cases of supposed difficult nature, conditions like nervousness, anemia, insomnia, nervous debility, hyperpyesis, neurasthenia, epilepsy, or a feeling of a load in the head. Women suffering from symptoms like these were sent to Dr. Seamus O'Kelly on 10 Upper Fitzwilliam Street, who billed the pension board 2 guineas exact per patient examined. The Belfast-born doctor and Gaelic scholar had practiced medicine in Patrick Pearse's school, St. Enda's, before studying obstetrics and gynaecology in Vienna. So I left Irish history aside for a bit, and I disappeared down a rabbit hole of reading medical histories from across the world. I learnt that gynaecological conditions were associated with women's emotional well-being right through much of the 20th century. Conditions like hysteria were associated with a wandering womb. So this explained why Irish doctors questioned women about their menstrual cycle as a first protocol when they struggled to deal with these intangible legacies of the revolution. Dr. O'Kelly's reports invariably included commentary on the women's state of mind during their visits to his office. The patient is exceedingly emotional. Patient seems in a highly strung and excitable condition. In fact, such was the connection between gynaecology and emotional well-being that IRA men were also sent to ladies' doctors during the revolutionary period if they were perceived to be low in health. Dr. Robert Farnan, another revolutionary and gynaecologist, was known to be able to cure nervous IRA activists who were serving in Michael Collins' squad by merely speaking to the men. His women patients, however, tended to be prescribed rest cures that comprised of lengthy periods relaxing outdoors or by the sea, illustrating, I suppose, how women's medical treatment was less directed towards their social reintegration than that of their male comrades. But reading these files can also feel voyeuristic. Thousands are available at a click of a mouse online, files that contain glimpses into the lives of those who lived during this period. But this is not necessarily the picture they themselves chose to leave behind. For former women activists, applying for recognition from the Pensions Board was often a lengthy and painstaking process. The retelling of traumatic experience to the state for the sake of financial compensation could in itself be re-traumatising. Women write about smuggling guns, about caring for the injured and the dying, about enduring raids on their homes. The recording of such domestic violations is then extended through the invasive gynecological testings that they are required to undertake. The files make uncomfortable reading. I fumble over gynecological terms like amenorrhea, leucorrhea, endometrius. And even then, most claims are unsuccessful. These medical complaints could be deemed not associated with active service. Nervous conditions were actually seen as a natural part of women's makeup and not therefore a result of their revolutionary activism. Dr. O'Kelly does speculate in one case whether a patient's severe pelvic disease, which led to a hysterectomy at a young age, might have been as a result of the tuberculous process that she contracted during the revolutionary period. But ultimately, her application, like so many, is turned down. I write about these women, carefully footnoting their cases as the academic conventions dictate. And I wonder, how did they feel as they travelled for these invasive medical investigations? Did they feel dread? Or was there a glimmer of hope that they would finally be listened to? And how would they feel now, as their doctor's notes spark the interests of historians like me? Maybe even more so than their carefully written accounts of their exploits and dangerous deeds. Sometimes I write their names, convincing myself that their intimate cases mattered and continue to matter in a system in which 100 years later, women's health remains woefully misunderstood. Other times I scratch out the identifiers, and by returning them to anonymity, I hope to give them back some of the dignity they deserved. I continue searching in the many thousands of files in the Military Service Pensions collection, but struggle often to find answers, still wavering over how best to represent the people whose most intimate experiences are now available online at the click of a mouse.
Two weeks to go before Christmas, the town was not as busy as you might expect. The coal quay was emptying quickly, the last few holly sellers trying to get rid of their bundles before closing up, and everyone huddled up against the cold and encroaching darkness, because everyone was anxious, like people awaiting the arrival of a storm. That was hardly surprising, considering the armed patrols in the streets, the random stop and search by auxiliaries or blackened hands, the feeling of vengeance about to be taken. For it was the 11th of December 1920, only 2 weeks after the ambush at Kilmichael, just west of Cork City, when 16 auxiliaries were killed by the IRA. The newly formed K Company of auxiliaries were in town and looking to settle the score. That night, after dark, an IRA ambush on a patrol near Victoria Barracks led to immediate reprisals on the residents of nearby Dillon's Cross. Crown forces burned houses, assaulted local residents and conducted random arrests. Very quickly, the reprisals spread into the middle of town, where lorry loads of black and tans and auxiliaries began to drive through the city streets, shooting in the air and harassing and terrifying civilians. Later, they targeted prominent shops and business premises in and around the city centre, breaking in, looting and ransacking them, and then setting fire to them. In the small hours of the morning, they shot dead the two Delaney brothers over in Blackpool. Like many Cork people, I had grown up knowing about these events, but I had never fully engaged with the details or thought hard about the bewildering confusion and chaos as that night unfolded. That was until a few years ago, when we were awash with centenaries of various kinds, and I began to read and explore some of the witness statements. I was struck by how little Cork people were aware of the destruction and reconstruction of their city. One side of the city's main street almost entirely destroyed. Over 2,000 people out of work and many hundreds left homeless. The City Hall and Carnegie Library burned to the ground. So, a small group of us, people involved in theatre and art and literature in Cork, came up with a plan for a major spectacular public event to commemorate the centenary of the burning of Cork City Centre. Our commemorative proposal was nothing if not ambitious. We would use digital mapping to visually reconstruct the burning of Patrick Street. An audience of thousands along the north side of the street would see and hear the progress of the burning, images of buildings being looted, then torched with petrol or hand grenades and Very lights, as auxiliaries, black and tans and RSE ran amok. Live action might be part of the event. Crosley tenders loaded with community cast racing down Patrick Street. Gunfire, terrified shop assistants being ushered out in huddled groups or carted off to Union Quay or the Bridewell. A Cecil B. DeMille production. Well, perhaps we were overambitious. We didn't get the funds or the backing for our plan. And a year later, it was cold comfort to realise that even if we had got the go-ahead, a little complication called the coronavirus meant it would never have happened anyway. However, the research we had done for that proposal left me haunted by the stories, images and voices I had encountered. The before and after photographs, the hapless eyewitness statements, the tiny fragments of people's lives glimpsed in the pages of reports. One of the biggest surprises was the discovery that the 11th of December was also the final night of his show, Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers, in the Cork Opera House. The choice of show alone caught my attention. The Gondoliers is a typical Gilbertian nonsense in which one of two cheerful, amorous Venetian gondoliers seems to be the lost heir to the kingdom of Barataria. But Venice was a republic, and these gondoliers were stout republicans. As one of them says, "We are jolly gondoliers, republicans heart and soul. We hold all men to be equal. As we abhor oppression, we abhor kings." In 1889, in the Savoy Theatre in London, this was a colourful and amusing fancy. In Cork, in 1920, with the war between Crown forces and Republicans on the streets all around them, there can be no doubt that the show must have had a markedly different resonance. And then the other questions popped up. How did word of the trouble filter into the building? What effect did it have on the audience? Or on the performers? What happened to those last night backstage flirtations? How did those people even get home? Well, I'm not a historian. I couldn't research and answer all those questions. I did what I felt was the next best thing. I wrote a novel, Songs for a Burning City, reimagining the many experiences and challenges of ordinary people at the Opera House that night. Those who had just set out for an evening of music and escape. I'd never written anything like that before, but oddly, when it was published, I felt as if some weight of obligation had been lifted. An obligation to whom? To the city? To the forgotten gondolieri? to the dead? That was when I came across a comment by Hilary Mantel, writer of Wolf Hall. Challenged about the issue of accuracy in writing historical fiction, she said, "In imagination, we chase the dead, shouting, 'Come back!' We may suspect that the voices we hear are an echo of our own, and the movement we see is our own shadow. But we sense the dead have a vital force still. They have something to tell us, something we need to understand. Using fiction and drama, we try to gain that understanding."
We're called gondolieri, but that's a baggeri. It's quite honorary, the trade that we ply. For gallantry noted, since we were short-coated, to beauty devoted, Giuseppe and I.
The Christmas Angel at Chartres. A fierce flurry tries to shove me back inside the train, but I resist and glide through sleet-buffeted, glittery streets, cathedral towers playing hide-and-seek, as I turn a corner here, there, recalling Rodin and Rilke, arriving on a winter's day, Rodin abusing Chartres' Gothic scowls. Rilke scarfed against the blizzard of words, the east wind embittering his eyes. And his life in flux, marriage flailing, and Rodin still relentless in his grousing. Until they turn the corner, I now turn, and all at once we see the angel, the slender angel low down on the wall, who's holding out an offering, a semicircular stone, a sundial, dissolving time to a stick of shadow that's poised like a fishing float, poised to pull quicksilver life from flux, and if only for a moment tear the spirit from the body and raise it high, shimmering and wriggling into the element of air.
On this morning's programme, we heard Edward Keegan by Declan Kybird. Pork Chops, Peas, Chips, Tea, Bread and Butter was by Jim Maguire. A Field of Dreams, Remembering Sheila Holland by Mary Hassett. Irish Revolutionaries and the Gynecologists was by Siafra Aitken. The Burning of Cork and Songs for a Burning City by Ger Fitzgibbon. And The Christmas Angel at Chartres, a poem by James Harper. The music was Open the Door Softly from an album of Beethoven's Irish songs by the Richard Carr Consort. Last Christmas by Wham. Scenes That Are Brightest from the opera Maritana by William Vincent Wallace, sung by Cara O'Sullivan with the RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by Pruncius O'Dain. The Seas Are Deep by Carolyn, played by the Michael Hermack Consort. And We're Called Gondolieri by Gilbert and Sullivan, sung by Richard Lewis and John Cameron with the ProArte Orchestra, conducted by Malcolm Sargent. And just to note, Siafra Aitken's script was recorded at a past Sunday Miscellany live in the dock in Carrick on Shannon in County Leitrim. Spreading the News, a celebration of the Abbey Theatre at 120, will be broadcast on RTE Radio 1 at 6 o'clock on the 27th of December. Songs for a Burning City by Ger Fitzgibbon is published by Menma Books. Their website is menma.eu. And Sunday Miscellany's latest anthology is a selection from 2018 to 2023, and it's published by New Ireland. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to this programme on the RTE Radio Player or at the programme website, Go to rte.ie/radio.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.